I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to The Connection. 400 years ago in colonial America, a person who called themselves Thomas and Thomasine Hall lived a double identity. They dress as a man or a woman depending on the circumstances. Their gender ambiguity caused quite an uproar, including inspections of their body and eventually a legal ruling that determined Hall was both male and female. As punishment, they were forced to wear men's clothing with a woman's head covering and an apron. Our guest, Rebecca Davis, writes in her new book, Fierce Desires, that Hall chose to live outside the expectations of that time and define gender on their own terms. Davis's book is a sweeping history of sex and sexuality in America, revealing both changing mores and longstanding tensions between what society considers acceptable behavior and the personal quest for erotic liberation, a conflict that continues today. Rebecca Davis is a professor of history, gender, and women's studies at the University of Delaware. Her newsletter, Carnal Knowledge, explores how sexuality shapes our politics and culture, and she is sitting across from me. Rebecca Davis, nice to have you with us on The Connection.
I'm delighted to be here.
You know, sex and sexuality and what people do in the privacy of their own bedroom is such a private act. And usually only the participants really know what goes on between two people or more. As a historian, how do you get to the truth about what people do in their private lives?
Right. And I go about this differently than someone who is a political scientist or sociologist or psychologist would go about it. What I do and what historians do is we look to the archives. We look for documentation. We also more recently do a lot of oral histories and listen back to oral histories. And in the history of sexuality, a lot of the earlier records show us when something went wrong.
Right.
There was a conflict, there was violence, there was an unmarried person who became pregnant or something of that kind. And that's when records show up. So we have a skewed understanding of what happened in the past unless we have people's own voices. And for much of the early part of the period that I study, most of the voices of people describing their own desires were men of some privilege who were not only literate and had the resources, but then had the ensuing resources to be able to preserve their material goods and pass them down. Today, we have an abundance of sources.
Indeed, we do.
But for the historian, we really dig around and we try to find other people's voices in what's left. We really try to, if it's a white, you know, Englishman writing about enslaved people or Native Americans, we really try to take what we know from archaeologists and anthropologists, from later histories of indigenous people, and combine that with that source to try to get a variety of perspectives.
I must say, from reading your book and looking back over these 400 years in America, colonial America, of course, at the beginning, there seems like there's this constant push and pull between, you know, punishment and pleasure, between avoidance and putting someone in jail, for instance.
Right. I mean, at the one of the frameworks that I find helpful that I kept reminding myself about was how fragile these early colonial settlements were of English people and other Europeans. And so on the one hand, you have people, Puritans coming who have very strongly held religious beliefs about when sex is moral, when it's immoral. On the other hand, there are very, very few of them. They're surrounded by indigenous people who aren't super thrilled that they're there, that they're often at war with and attacking and being aggressors toward. So they make choices about when they're going to put resources into policing or punishing people's sexuality and what they will just try to ignore and move on with. It's not the case that they could go out and prosecute every case of adultery. They didn't have the wherewithal to do that.
And it does raise questions about just how Puritan were the Puritans, right?
Right.
When you begin to dig in, there was this thing called bundling, which allowed people to essentially sleep together before they got married.
Yes. I mean, by the 1750s, 1760s, there was this, we think, Northern European practice that was brought to America with, I mean, if you can imagine it, people had very little furniture for the most part, unless you were very wealthy. When we go on colonial house tours today, we're seeing the homes of the wealthy and who had lots of furniture. Most people had very little. So it was normal that if a guest came to your home, the children would all sleep in one bed together to leave some place for the guest, or the guest would climb into bed with the children or with the adults of the house. What starts to happen is there becomes this sort of folk practice of allowing male suitors to climb into bed overnight with the young women they were interested in. And the young woman's family would also be in the home. So historians have some young men's accounts of how exciting and what a great time they were having with this practice. We also can imagine that for parents who were worried about a premarital pregnancy, this allowed them to know exactly who their daughter's suitors were. And so because premarital pregnancy rates were going up and young people were resisting parental authority in new ways by the 1760s, 1770s. So it's a way to have fun. It's a way to allow unmarried people a certain kind of pleasure. And it's also a way for parents to try to keep an eye on what's going on.
And sort of who's connected to who, yes. If there is offspring. But there had to have been some form of contraception, some ways of having abortions in order to prevent an unwanted pregnancy.
There were a couple things that I could say about that. We know that pessaries or things to block the entrance to the cervix have existed since ancient times. So there have always been ways that people tried to control pregnancies. We also know that in, say, the 1700s, North American women were often very proud of large families. So they would not necessarily have seen controlling their fertility as a goal. At the same time, an unmarried pregnancy was socially devastating. Mm-hmm. So we do have cases of unmarried young women seeking out abortion, less about using contraception if you were an unmarried woman. We just don't have much evidence of that, though we can imagine that it would have taken place. Things like condoms would have been known to maybe some sex workers or the clients of sex workers, but would not have been considered a respectable option for most people.
I began by talking about Thomas Thomasine Hall, which was a really fascinating story in this book. And they lived in Jamestown area when all this kind of came to a head. And as you say, they represented this sort of willingness to buck tradition and to be who they were. Was this a transgender person? Was this an intersex person? Do we know?
We don't know. We have 2 pages of documentation total of anything about this person's life. They were brought before the general court in Jamestown, and the handwritten and now transcribed court record is all that we know about this person. Mm-hmm. And from that, we know that they came from England, that they had fought for England and France. They had grown up as a female child, learning to be a seamstress, then had been a male soldier, and then were living and working as a female domestic servant in this colonial community. I mean, one of the ways to think about this is, so people looked at this person's body and reached different conclusions.
And there were all these inspections of their body.
Yes, and fully disagreed about what they had seen with their own eyes. So that's an interesting piece of it. We also know this little fragment of text in the document that where Hall basically says that they had a piece of flesh that, you know, we can imagine there are intersex conditions that lead to differently sized genitalia. We can imagine that any sort of variation in human sexuality was present in this person. But we can also imagine that in a world where you didn't have the communication that we have today, there were probably lots of other Halls. There were probably lots of other people who could move from an island nation to the continent, could sail across the Atlantic and reimagine their gender or re-express their gender in that new place without people knowing. There were probably many who weren't discovered.
Well, and you even say sort of by not naming it and having a sort of diagnosis for it, perhaps led to people's willingness to engage in a variety of different kinds of sexual behaviors.
Right. I mean, there was this definite prioritization among European white settlers for married intercourse for the purposes of producing children. There was also a celebration of marital sex as this very special and even sacred, God-affirming activity. Beyond that, there were notions of sin. There were ideas about adultery and fornication and sodomy as sinful acts that were then written into the criminal code in a lot of the colonies. But there were very few prosecutions for any of these things.
Yeah.
And a lot of expressions of, so for example, none of those things would cover two women having sex play together, you know, being intimate with each other. The sodomy, except briefly in New Haven Colony, did not include women. So there's that. We can also think about people for whom sodomy meant a very specific kind of sex between men, and that other kinds of sexual intimacy between men wouldn't have fallen under that definition, and so wouldn't have appeared sinful to them.
And the notion of friend, I'm using quotations here, having a friend, could be a lover. I mean, it could be to someone that you have this intense erotic relationship with.
That's right. We see, too, in the Revolutionary era, the early National era, lots of passionate letters among some of the men who were central to the founding of this country that have language almost identical to the romantic letters that men wrote to the women that they were courting. There was a language of romance and of romantic love and of friendship that was quite passionate. And we think that some of these relationships were erotic, and we have varying glimpses of evidence of that in some of these letters in a way that they didn't try to hide, right? These weren't letters that were sent undercover. They weren't written in a code. They were very clear in expressing.
They signed them.
They signed them, yeah. And sometimes these letters were shown to members of the family, and members of the family wrote postscripts on the letter back. There wasn't a sense of shame around passionately loving a very close friend of the same sex.
Almost up in a break here, but I mean, that's so interesting. So on one hand, you have the sort of shaming that comes from the elders or perhaps even the church. And the other hand, you have the sort of embrace of a passionate love that someone might have for a quote-unquote friend.
You do, and I think that it's a reminder that at any point in time, there's never one way of thinking about sex and sexuality, that it's always a conversation. There are always different impulses, different ways of thinking about things. So when we hear anyone in our world today talk about some simpler time when everybody agreed, I've never seen that in the historical record.
Because we're talking about people, right? We're talking about human beings.
Yes.
And human beings are complicated and sexual and all of the above.
Yes, and people are able to hold two conflicting ideas in their head at the same time.
Exactly. Well, I'll tell you what, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. And our guest is historian Rebecca L. Davis, and she's got a new book. It's titled Fierce Desires, and it's subtitled A New History of Sex and Sexuality in America. And she is a professor of history, gender, and women's studies at the University of Delaware. And as I mentioned earlier, she's got a newsletter. It's called Carnal Knowledge, and it explores how sexuality shapes our politics and our culture. And that is what we are talking about today on The Connection. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
We live in a time of sexual upheaval involving identity, gender, and erotic behavior. Today on The Connection, why this is nothing new. And our guest is historian Rebecca Davis. She's got a new book called Fierce Desires. Well, just kind of marching through history here, you write in the 17th century, quote, correct sexual behavior became an essential means of distinguishing Christian from heathen, civilized from savage. Perhaps starting with, quote unquote, the savage, but native populations. Obviously, there was a lot of attempt to convert native people to Christianity. How did sex get involved?
Looking at the big sweep of this book, I realized that there were three major models for thinking about the role of sex in people's lives. One is that you behave sexually as your community or your values or your religion teaches you. More modern is that you have some internal part of yourself that you express through your sexuality. But a third piece was deciding who other people were based on their sexuality. And so it's not only that Protestants and Catholics who came to North America were very intent on converting Native people, but they viewed the sexual practices of Indigenous people as an indication of whether they were valuable humans or not, or what kind of people they were. And so it wasn't, it was evidence of a successful conversion if they gave up polygamy and formed marital households and stopped practices like what we might call queer sex that Catholic missionaries in particular were very upset about. But it's also that to justify obscene acts of violence, some of these European settlers could say, well, we know these aren't people as worthy as we are of rights and freedoms because look at their gender expression. Indigenous people had, in most Indigenous nations in North America, there were some variation of a person who's what we today call two-spirit, or a person with a fluid gender identity of some kind. And this wasn't Thomas Hall aside, this was not normative in these European cultures. And so, yeah, it really becomes a way to both try to coerce people to be the same and then to justify their difference.
Well, and as you say that thinking about slavery in this country, that white women were seen as weak, they were seen as virginal, in need of some form of protection. Enslaved women were seen as promiscuous, and enslaved men were seen as predators, when, of course, in reality, it was the white men who were raping black women, and it was black men who were lynched or killed, accused of seducing white women.
Right.
Which sort of turns the whole thing on its head.
I think one of the most, for me, important and devastating parts of researching and writing this book was reading about the history of sexuality under enslavement.
Yeah.
And we have overlooked for too long the importance of sexual coercion to the entire functioning of the American economy, because slavery fueled the American economy, and with the expansion of the cotton economy and by the 1840s and 50s, as the cotton economy was pushing further west and with new territory, there was this literal drive to create more people who would labor in those labor camps. And coerced sex was part of that. The United States no longer participated in the international slave trade. And so enslaved women bore this terrible burden of at once finding ways to be maternal and nurturing and loving in parts of families and kinship networks, and also dealing with extreme threats of sexual coercion. And it really shaped that whole experience.
I mean, it's a terror campaign. We're really talking about terrorism here.
Yes, absolutely. And the myth about black men, the rape myth about black men, in fact, takes off in new and more malicious ways after the Civil War. And it predates the Civil War, but it becomes far more sort of expansive and vile after the Civil War as a way to rein in black emancipation and as a way to punish black people who were excelling and achieving and expressing the pleasure of freedom. There were no white men accused of charged with raping a black woman until well into the 20th century. But of course that happened, but there was not a single prosecution. The entire justice system acted as if that didn't happen.
And if we know this history and the history is true, what does that say about today?
That's a big question. I think that what we can look at today is what I'm reminded of is to listen to the voices of people who are not necessarily in positions of authority, but who are speaking with urgency and clarity about their own experiences. So we have a crisis now in black maternal mortality, and we should be listening to policymakers, all of us should be listening more closely to Black women's experiences of pregnancy and labor and broader healthcare issues. When we hear about trans issues in the news, we should be listening to trans people and centering their voices in any way that we approach these things. If we go back and we try to listen, find the voices of enslaved women, they are clearly telling us what's happening. They are telling us how appalled they are. And they're showing through their behavior attempts to resist and attempts to still find some freedom or some beauty amid a truly terrible situation.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's Rebecca Davis. She is our guest today on The Connection. She's a historian at the University of Delaware, and we're talking about her new book. It's titled Fierce Desires, A New History of Sex and Sexuality in America. Well, let's take a slight step forward and talk about Anthony Comstock. I think people are more familiar with his name perhaps now than they were a couple of years ago. He was a anti-sex vigilante of the sort of mid to late 19th century. He spearheaded and was the person behind the Act for the Suppression of Trade in and Circulation of Obscene Literature and Articles of Immoral Use, otherwise known as the Comstock Act, which outlawed erotica, contraception, and abortifacients. Mm-hmm. How was he able to do this? I mean, this one man.
That's the million-dollar question. I mean, he started doing it on his own. He was a young man living in New York City, and he felt moral indignation over the existence of commercialized sex. And so he would barge into bookstores and try to do a citizen's arrest. And these kept getting overturned because you can't just go in and take somebody's merchandise. But he was trying to do this. And he eventually got the ear of some wealthier, more powerful people at the YMCA. And they created an ancillary organization, the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice, and gave him some funding. Because they were generally agreed that pornography was a stain on the moral fabric of the nation or whatever. And so he then went down to Washington, D.C. and did a sort of show and tell of pornography and sex toys to members of Congress, which there are no images of, much to our
wouldn't that be great
today,
as a historian, right?
But he, I mean, it's a typical story of the anti-porn crusader, is that they devote their lives to looking at the material and then arguing that looking at this material really messes you up, so we shouldn't let anybody do it. But he was obsessed with getting this material out of the public sphere. He took paintings of female nudes out of restaurants. He wanted in Philadelphia at art schools, he wanted there to be no more nude models in the human drawing from nature classes. So he sort of assigned himself this job and managed to convince a majority of Congress to include this act. It cost them nothing. His funding didn't come from Congress. He got a federal title as a postal inspector. His money continued to come from the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice, it's my understanding. Wow. So it didn't cost them much to do it, and they could show that they were crusading for the morality of the nation.
And just to continue this tension theme, at the same time you've got, you know, Fannie Hill, erotica, you've got the Chicago World's Fair where there were, you know, risque dances going on. So you've got these two worlds that sort of live side by side. But obviously he did great harm to people because he was taking away people's rights to live the life that they wanted to live.
He did. And he went after certain people in particular. He went after women who were outspoken defenders or providers of abortion or contraception. And he went after free speech radicals. There was this emerging movement by the 1880s, even a little earlier, but in the latter part of the 19th century, of people who were often atheists or agnostic. They were in favor of free speech. They wanted the state to get out of the business of regulating sexual morality. And Comstock went after these folks with a vengeance. He not only declared their publications obscene, but he arrested some of these editors, imprisoned people. He drove a couple of these people to suicide. Others, he sort of wrecked their health through these arrests and terms at hard labor. So he picked sort of high-profile people. He wasn't, though, going after the captains of industry whose companies produced things like Vaseline, which was used as both a lubricant or as a contraceptive. And so Colgate was fine, you know, but the small proprietors and then these outspoken radicals really felt the brunt of his scorn.
But as you say, during this time, birth rates dropped.
Yes.
So clearly people were doing something to prevent pregnancy. I'm sure to his shock and horror, there were speakeasies. There was something called the Comstock syringe.
Yes.
So there were ways of kind of tweaking him and belittling him.
Yes, he was reviled by a large portion of the American public. And of course, the Comstock syringe was a tongue-in-cheek name for something that might have been used to douche or something like that. He was ridiculed in a lot of more left-leaning publications. A lot of people rolled their eyes at him. He was sort of to many people, a ridiculous figure in his zeal. But he managed to have, I mean, I think as an example of somebody who really doesn't have the popular will, whose views are quite antagonistic and at odds with where the general culture is, having enormous influence over the consequences of having a sex life that differs from what he thinks it should be, or speaking out in favor of other people's right to have that sex life.
I mean, the Comstock Act is on the books today. People have used that after the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the passage of Dodds, to prevent the mailing of abortion medications. So, you know, something that goes back more than 100 years is still alive today, potentially doing some damage.
Yes, parts of the Comstock Act have been ruled unconstitutional bit by bit. And that really started with efforts by Margaret Sanger and early 20th century birth control activists to get medical exceptions so that doctors couldn't be prosecuted for giving information about contraception to patients, things like that, or prescribing contraceptives to them. But the part that bans the use of the U.S. mail for anything related to abortion was never formally struck down. And back in the 90s, the Justice Department reassured, you know, legislators, well, we're never going to enforce that, right? Let's leave it there. And so we live with the consequences of that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and again, the sort of A being of our sexual history in America, there's Ida Craddock, who was very much a proponent of pleasure and expression when it came to sexuality, a counterpart, I mean, someone that lived during the time of Comstock.
Ida Craddock was one of his enemy, you know, on his enemies list. And he did keep a list. He kept a list of people he had put in jail. He kept lists of people who had taken their own lives as a result of his persecution of them. But Ida Craddock was a Philadelphia woman who wanted to go to Penn and passed the exams but was denied entrance because she was a woman. But she was fascinated by anthropology, by ancient religion, and she had various day jobs to keep herself going. But she had a passion project, which was marital counseling.
Yeah.
And she did correspondence counseling with people. They would write to her of their troubles with a payment, and she would write back. And she had booklets for people about how to improve marital sex. And she was concerned with things that are extremely modern. She was asking questions of the men in her questionnaires that she sent out. Do you ask for permission? Do you seek consent? You know, and questions about, what is it that you're doing for the wife's pleasure in your sex together? And that put her way ahead of her time. And she was never married, she was never married in the way that we would think about it. She said she was. She said she had a spirit husband who lived in the world beyond, and that they were that they remained intimate, and that she had a wonderful sex life with him. But she really was standing up for this right, like a lot of the free speech activists of the day were, that this is about humanity. This is about the human condition. This is a natural thing. People worry about it. They have questions, and we should be able to answer those questions. And for that, she was arrested and imprisoned. And when Comstock went after her a second time, she just couldn't face it anymore.
I mean, that is such a tragedy. But it's so fascinating. She focused so much on a woman's pleasure.
Yes.
I mean, that was really critical from her perspective.
It was. And she's not the only one. I mean, we have voices going back I mean, even among the Puritans, there were midwifery manuals that suggested that conception could only occur if both partners orgasmed. So we have text, this is the 1600s. We have this idea that both partners, that they because they thought that each partner emitted a seed and that it was the blending of the two seeds that created a new human life. And we have that. We have early advocates for sexual or anatomical education in the early 1800s talking about women's bodies and pleasures. We have Sylvester Graham, who was big in the anti-masturbation movement. He gave lectures to young men, which we would expect, but he also gave lectures to young women, which suggests that there was an awareness that women were capable of self-pleasure and that, therefore, they needed to be warned against it just as young men did. So this recognition that sexual pleasure is important, is natural for women, is important to women, it's there all along, but it just keeps getting pushed to the background or silenced. And for people like Craddock, very harshly.
Indeed. And the anti-masturbation movement, how did that go?
Well, I mean, it's fascinating what a fixation it was. It was, part of it is, it was reflecting all these other cultural anxieties about young men who were maybe leaving the family farm, moving to the city, making their own way in the world. And would they be self-disciplined people? There was a theory that ejaculation was sort of a depletion of the body's energies. And so you had to reserve those energies in order to be highly functional in other areas of your life. So if young men were masturbating a lot, then they were, you know, going to be dissolute, you know, wrecks instead of good, capable citizens. There was so much antagonism toward it. And I think, how did it go? I just think that it left a lot of people feeling terribly guilty.
Again, we're talking about human beings here, right? Well, I'll tell you what, let's take another short break and then we will get back to our conversation. And again, Rebecca Davis is our guest today on The Connection. She's a historian, a professor of history, gender, and women's studies at the University of Delaware. And we are talking about her new book. It's titled Fierce Desires, A New History of Sex and Sexuality in America. And we are sort of taking steps marching through some of this history. After this very short break, we will talk about Kinsey and some of the things that are going on in America today. She's got a newsletter. It's called Carnal Knowledge, and it explores how sexuality shapes our politics and culture. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And our guest historian, Rebecca Davis, says that this country has always been in a state of sexual upheaval because of the tension between eroticism and moralism that's been with us for some 400 years. And she's got a new book we've been talking about, and it's called Fierce Desires. I mentioned Kinsey's, which takes us into the late 1930s, when the Kinsey Report comes out. I always thought it was fascinating because Kinsey was a zoologist. And the animal world is full of all the sort of permutations of what creatures can do with each other sexually. But how explosive was the Kinsey Report?
Right. So Kinsey starts teaching about human sexuality in the 30s. The first report is published in 48, the second in 1953. And the books were... they're one of the hinge points in my book. I do think that there's a before and an after the Kinsey reports. What Kinsey did with his research team was conduct thousands of very, very detailed, lengthy one-on-one interviews with people about their sexual behaviors. And he was committed to this idea of removing moralism and value judgments from a conversation about sex. He'd been asked to teach a class on it at Indiana University and didn't have much regard for the research he could find by other people. He thought they're all assuming that a certain kind of sex is better than another before they even go out and gather their data. And he wanted to do something different. His research method was very problematic. And so there are plenty of ways to pick apart the exact statistics that he presented in his books. There's no question about that. But what he showed conclusively is the extraordinary variation in human sexual behavior, and that he, statistically speaking, but also value speaking, the norm is variation. That there, the amount of premarital sex among women, the amount of queer sex among men, the amount of people having sex with other partners while married to someone else, that it was everywhere in the data that he pulled up, that there were all kinds of fetishes and desires that went way beyond any sort of sense that we're, that we are Comstock Nation, right?
Comstock Nation, yeah.
And it was a huge media sensation. There were tons of responses to it. And it continued to be sort of a thorn in the side of people who wanted to promote a more sort of Christian moralistic view of sexuality. And it got to this idea that just by publishing the reports, by telling people what he had found, Kinsey was sort of corrupting people or devaluing American life, that information was dangerous and that this sort of information shouldn't be put forth in, you know, such a public way.
I mean, he took the definition of sex beyond the binary, right? Right. That it's not either this or that, or people's identity is not either this nor that, that it is this mix of acts and feelings.
Absolutely. And it was really transformational too for people who had felt themselves, you know, had were feeling desires that didn't fit the model that the general culture promoted. They weren't desiring sex with someone of a different sex. They weren't picturing themselves in the suburban house with the white picket fence and all of that. And we have actually quite a bit of evidence of people talking about going to their library and searching for that copy of the Kinsey report that they could just sit and read. It's a very, very long, dense, dry book, but people talk about sort of reading it cover to cover and having this epiphany that they were not the only person in the world who had those kinds of desires, that in fact it was part of the human variation, and that was very affirming and radicalizing for some people.
Does that lead to gay rights, gay marriage, transgender issues? I mean, the things that we're dealing with today, the fact that Kinsey kind of opened up this world and said, look, this is what people are actually doing in their private lives.
He is certainly very important to that. I think another part of what happened was that starting in the 19—well, it goes back pretty far, but to just sort of keep it around this time period, the United States government, the federal government, starting in the 30s and in a major way by the 40s and 50s, starts to say that being homosexual, being queer, was contrary to being a good American citizen. So in World War II, for the first time, when you signed up to serve in the military, there were questions about whether or not you were homosexual. And if you were, you weren't supposed to be allowed in. If you were found to be gay or lesbian once you were already in the service, you were kicked out with dishonorable sort of discharge. And after the end of World War II, by 1947, the federal government puts in rules barring gay and lesbian people from federal employment. And that creates, and so it becomes extremely dangerous. So if you get now, if you get arrested for a raid on a gay bar, you would have your name and address and maybe the name of your employer printed in the newspaper. And if you're a federal employee, you'd be immediately fired. You'd be put on a list of people who are ineligible for those forms of employment. And so there's a whole sense of fear and coercion around that, which had ironically come in some ways from queer people really finding each other in the first half of the 20th century, of becoming more visible, of building communities that were celebratory and affirming, complicated. And so the gay rights movement that comes about by the 60s and 70s is a response in many ways to that post-World War II closet that the federal government puts in place. But it's also rooted in a longer history of community and sort of looking out for each other.
I mean, it's so interesting that sort of diagnosing something then makes it a pathology.
Yes.
And at the same time can lead to a greater understanding about how human behavior works And so there's this fight between these two parts of our personality and our identity that gets played out.
It was an interesting tension in the early gay rights movement, too, over should lesbians, for example, there were a lesbian group out in California that initially wanted to sit down with psychiatrists and psychologists and sort of learn from them, you know, what is the lesbian? What is our psychology? And then other members of the group saying, what are you talking about? We know who we are. We should be teaching them what it means to have a lesbian psychology or lesbian desires and so on. And so there is this ongoing tension over who are the voices of authority. We see that again in the early years of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, of people with AIDS storming the stage of a medical conference on HIV/AIDS and saying, no one on this panel has this illness. And you're telling us what our illness feels like and how it manifests. You need to listen to our voices. And so there's, I think it's a people finding their voices and right. and needing to sort of assert how their identity matters in these big public conversations.
I mean, it's the labels and the voices, right,
yes.
that are sort of in conflict with each other. And it should be said that the DSM, which is the diagnostic manual, it wasn't really until a couple of decades ago that homosexuality was taken out of the DSM.
Right, right. The movement to move it from being listed as sort of a pathology out of that category happened in the 70s, but it did sort of remain as a category for longer than that. Yeah, and you know, we see this too today with issues around trans healthcare, because for a physician to get insurance reimbursement, they have to provide a diagnostic code.
Right.
So there's all this conversation that goes on and on among physicians, activists, patients, family members of patients over what do we call what this is, how do we categorize it, and therefore what kinds of treatment are we able to provide in a licit way.
I'm looking at the clock here, and I want to put in a couple of more issues here. One, of course, is the pill and the sexual revolution, the idea that you could decouple pregnancy from sex, frankly. Just, I mean, if you live through it, it's hard to know how revolutionary that was. But as a historian, how revolutionary was that?
It was major. I mean, I enjoyed reading more recently about Margaret Sanger, that she had a lot of sexual partners while she was married and then after her divorce, and she didn't want to get pregnant. And so one of her motivations for pushing in the 1910s and 20s for greater access to, at the time, the diaphragm was that, well, all of her radical left male friends were out enjoying free love. She wanted to do the same thing. But this idea that women should have all the sex that they want to have for all the reasons they want to have it has been one of the most radical and fiercely contested ideas in the history that I trace. And it's sort of hard to overstate how upsetting that idea has been to many people in positions of authority, and how important it was to, for example, the anti-abortion movement and to efforts of to say that there's one kind of family or there's one kind of morality that it should be acceptable.
Speaking of abortion, I mean, obviously we're now living in a time of Dobbs, the overthrowing of Roe v. Wade and sending this issue back to the courts with this real mixed bag of results and some people really suffering and frankly dying as a result of this decision. As a historian, then, does this feel like we've gone backwards in time when it comes to the issue of abortion?
In some ways, yes. I mean, I think that many people took for granted the permanency of Roe v. Wade. But we've long had this idea that the way people behave sexually was not really up to them, but should be a reflection of what other people determine is appropriate sexual behavior. And that's often very rooted in very narrow ideas of the gender binary, that there's men, there's women, there's no fluidity, and that their roles are defined by that existence. And the anti-abortion movement in the United States has for decades promoted its opposition to abortion within that framework. They've been saying to us pretty clearly that we know better than women who seek abortions what they should be doing with their bodies. And it's an old idea. It goes back to these, you know, 1600s ideas. And there was, I think, a false hope in the era of Roe and of liberation that we were done with all of that. But it never went away. It was always part of the American conversation. And we're now just seeing what happens when people in positions of enormous authority are from that sexual tradition.
But you think that it will never go away because it's about women and sex and pleasure? That is just so provocative for some people?
I think there will always be resistance to it. I also really want to credit the women's movement, the LGBTQ rights movement, the reproductive justice movements of the last 50 years, because it is very different today than it was. Our ability to have this conversation in this way is a reflection of all of the gains that have been made by earlier generations of activists. So yes, we are in a moment of crisis, but we also have a far more educated and engaged general public when it comes to defending sexual freedom.
Well, one of the things that you say in your book is that when it comes to sexual identity, which is how we talk about it now, that a couple hundred years ago, it wasn't about identity. It was about your status. It was about your place in the community. It was something outside of yourself. And today, it's who people say they are.
Right. And I think that that idea is upsetting to people who really think that we are assigned roles based upon the sex assigned to us at birth, and that those roles aren't even just societal, they're divine, and that we as individuals have to fit ourselves into those molds in order to be worthy of other rights and freedoms. And yeah, but more and more people, I think, have a sense of themselves in which their sexuality is part of their individuality and not something that they want to corral into someone else's vision, but something they really want to be able to express.
And there's this sort of, there's the gender identity and sexual orientation. And I think for a lot of people, you know, in the olden days, it was, you know, there were these two paths. And now it's just this, you know, mix of choices that people have.
It is. And I think about this a lot when around issues of trans rights and folks worrying about, you know, why are there so many, quote unquote, more kids who identify as trans? And I think, looking at this as a historian, that what we're seeing is what happens when you open, when you sort of say, forget about those older categories. What do you think you are? Like, what do you want to call yourself? How do you want to live? And that so many people would come up with a different name for who they are and what they desire if left to their own devices, that we have been instead, you know, putting people in categories that they didn't want to be in for a very long time.
We're almost out of time here, but I wanted to read something that you wrote. It was in Time magazine after Dr. Ruth died, and you had a really lovely sort of homage to her. But you write, her optimistic outlook emerged from a childhood of unimaginable loss and struggle, making her emphasis on joy a choice, not merely a quirk of personality. Dr. Ruth left a legacy of sexual candor and the need to defend pleasure as a universal right, a conversation that is more relevant today than ever. And I mean, she did have this very joyous persona. She also seemed like such a grandmother. So whatever she said, it had a different kind of impact.
Yes. I mean, she was in her late 40s or early, I think close to 50, which is the age I am now, when she got her first radio show and started to do this work. So she was not a young woman. She was a middle-aged woman when she started doing it. And her thick accent was charming to a lot of people as well. But if you listen to what she's saying, it's the conversation we're having now 40 years later after her show went on the air about, you know, that it's okay to ask these questions and people should absolutely get frank answers to their questions about their bodies.
And how about now? We're almost up, almost out of time here. But in fact, we have about 30 seconds. But where do you think we are now?
I think we're in a crisis. I think that we are, I mean, I don't think we know kind of how this is going to play out in the under a Trump administration. But I do think, I take hope from the amount of outrage and activism that we've seen over the last 10 years or so, building upon activism that goes back generations, and a real emphasis on autonomy in American public life that I think we can all, you know, take hope from.
Well, we always like to end on a hopeful note. Rebecca Davis, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for writing this book as well. It's really fascinating.
Oh, thank you so much.
You're welcome. And again, Rebecca Davis, our guest. The book is titled Fierce Desires, A New History of Sex and Sexuality in America. She's a professor of history, gender, and women's studies at the University of Delaware. And her newsletter, Carnal Knowledge, explores how sexuality shapes our politics and culture. Well, thank you for joining us on The Connection as well. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Instagram and find us on Facebook and sign up for our newsletter at whyy.org/theconnection. Al Bang's the engineer for today's edition of the show, and it's produced by Debbie Builder with Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks for joining us.